This podcast is for alcoholics that have a willingness to recover from their alcoholism by being taught and practicing the principles of the 12 steps as outlined in the Big Book and the 12 and 12 of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Ilya, and I am an alcoholic. Page XIII, forward to first edition, first paragraph. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. We think this account of our experiences will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person, and besides, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. Alright, so we are continuing with step 9 in the 12 and 12. We just finished step 8 in the same book, and we've learned that a list and willingness are two parts to the 8th step, and the 8th step taught us that there are obstacles that prevent us from wanting to make amends or being willing to make amends, even though we may have put them on a list. And we went over those obstacles in detail. And there's also instincts that we have that are under threat that harm people as a result of our character defects. So now that we understand who we've harmed, we have to become willing to make amends to them. And that leads us right into 9, where we actually make the amends themselves. So if you turn to the summary in the table of contents, which is on page 7, towards the bottom of the page, the step is, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. A tranquil mind is the first requisite for good judgment. Good timing is important in making amends. What is courage? Prudence means taking calculated chances. Amends begins when we join AA. Peace of mind cannot be bought at the expense of others. Need for discretion, readiness to take consequences of our past and to take responsibility for well-being of others is the spirit of step 9. So again, those are all of the major bullet points summarized in step 9. So now we'll turn to the step itself in the 12 and 12, and that is on page 83. So first we're going to talk about the first requisite, which is timing. First paragraph on 83, good judgment, a careful sense of timing, courage, and prudence. These are the qualities we shall need when we take step 9. After we have made the list of people we have harmed, have reflected carefully upon each instance, and have tried to possess ourselves of the right attitude in which to proceed, we will see that the making of direct amends divides those we should approach into several classes. There will be those ought to be dealt with just as soon as we become reasonably confident that we can maintain our sobriety. There will be those to whom we can make only partial restitution, lest complete disclosure to them or others more harm than good. There will be other cases where action ought to be deferred, and still others in which, by the very nature of the situation, we shall never be able to make for direct personal contact at all. So I did discuss in the last podcast that each instance is unique, and you need to speak with your sponsor or your counsel before you take any drastic action. It's important to not try to bring other people into your amends before you have done everything you can to take a tactful approach and have a good sense of timing, courage, and prudence. And it's really, really hard to do that. If you want to go it alone, you'll probably do it anyway. But I certainly did a couple cases, and I do regret them. So just an advisement out there for you people who don't want to run certain amends past your sponsor. So there's different types of amends. But we do make amends from the moment that we join AA, and it says that in the second paragraph or the third paragraph. Most of us begin making certain kinds of direct amends from the day we join Alcoholics Anonymous. The moment we tell our families that we are really going to try the program, the process has begun. In this area, there are seldom any questions of timing or caution. We want to come in the door shouting the good news. After coming from our first meeting, or perhaps after we have finished reading the book Alcoholics Anonymous, we usually want to sit down with some member of the family and readily admit the damage we have done by our drinking. Almost always, we want to go further and admit our defects and have made us hard to live with. This will be a very different occasion, in sharp contrast with those hangover mornings when we alienated between reveling ourselves and blaming the family and everyone else for our troubles. At this first meeting, it is necessary only that we make a general admission of our defects. It may be unwise at this stage to rehash certain harrowing episodes. Good judgment will suggest that we ought to take our time. While we may be quite willing to reveal the very worst, we must be sure to remember that we cannot buy our own peace of mind at the expense of others. So when I was new, that is exactly what I did. I came home shouting the good news to my mother and father. My father wasn't alive, but I went to his gravesite and let him know. And my mother had to listen to me talk about how I was going to cure the world of alcoholism now that I had a solution. She was grateful that I wasn't drinking, but at the same time, I certainly went much further than I would have if I wasn't new. Clearly, there's an excitement when you make a decision to work a program of any kind, whether it's AA or not. You've made a decision to quit drinking, and that is an immediate amend that your family is going to start to understand is taking place. There's still a lack of trust. They may have heard it before, but we'll see, you know, is what they're thinking, whether or not you'll actually be able to go through with it in the long run. So it is important to try to be a little bit less forward and just explain to them what it is that you've decided to do, and that there's going to be a long period of reconstruction ahead, and hopefully they'll be able to tolerate you know, some of the mistakes you make along the way. Not every day is going to be a great day. There's going to be days where we digress. I certainly did, and I felt like you know, the whole point of drinking the whole point of not drinking was a bad idea on certain days. I needed a quick fix at certain times, and I got into depressions, and I got frustrated and excited, and I missed some of my old friends. But yes, there were no more hangover mornings, and I wasn't always blaming others for my troubles. When I did feel good, it was really good. But when I didn't feel good, it was really low. And that first year of sobriety is literally an emotional roller coaster. There's days where you're going to be very much up and very much down. You just have to tough it out and continue to go to meetings and continue to identify with other alcoholics and share in the rooms. Learning this program is first, but without fellowship and without going to meetings and without identification, you can take this book and read it all by yourself, and you probably won't get through that first year. Maybe if you were on a deserted island and had no choice, your higher power would help you if there was a fully stocked bar. I don't know. Maybe the deserted island means there's no booze and you'd have no choice. But in any case, I don't recommend avoiding meetings and just studying the literature by yourself. But I do recommend that you find a meeting where the literature is discussed. And if you're really lucky, you'll find a meeting where all they do is read out of the literature, and then they discuss the paragraph that was read, like I'm doing in this podcast. I read a paragraph and I discuss it. When you're in a room of 20 or 30 people, maybe you can only read one paragraph, and everybody shares about their experience, strength, and hope, and then there's the hour up. And then, we move on to the next paragraph or to the next week, or day, depending how often you meet. In my group, we met once a week, and it took a year and a half to go through all 12 steps. And so it was a classroom environment, and there was a sponsor who sponsored 30 people. It was called a big book meeting. And a 12 and 12 literature meeting. So what we did is exactly what I'm doing here now. We went back and forth between the big book and the 12 and 12, depending upon what step we were on and where all the steps are in the literature, and tying them together. So the guy who taught that class had 30 years of sobriety, and he knew this program like a lawyer. He actually was a lawyer in his career, retired. So people kept asking him for help. As you can see, it's really difficult to repeat this whole program to one person at a time. So his best use of his time was to hold a big book sponsorship course where anyone that wanted to attend could. And so he taught the program to a room full of people rather than tutoring one person. So he wasn't necessarily a sponsor. I would call him now a big book sponsor to me, but I needed a different sponsor, not a teacher, to go through my personal life with. So I don't know if you have meetings like that where you are, but it was his way of making amends to society and to carrying this message. So he wasn't asked to stop teaching it because it was a voluntary position, and he by no means forced anybody to sit there and listen. The program can be taught in a number of ways. It wasn't really considered an AA typical meeting. It was just one person teaching, like he would to one on one, except one on 30, if you will. But everyone had a chance to share, and everyone got to understand it from his angle. And it's funny because a lot of people did walk out of the room because they didn't like the format. They thought that he was the leader, and that wasn't the purpose of an AA meeting, to have a leader. He was a teacher, and truthfully, it wasn't even in a where and when. So hey, if somebody wants to teach this program to 30 people in an hour and a half a week, who's to say that that's not allowed? I'm doing that now on a podcast. This guy grew up during a time where there was no internet. So if you're learning the program through me, great. But I do recommend that you get a sponsor, because you're going to need to be able to do a fifth step and be able to go over your amends list with a sponsor as well. That's the two most important times a sponsor comes in handy, is during the fifth and ninth step. But you're also going to need one when you're really new. You're going to need to call them frequently every time you're disturbed, just so you can get off your chest whatever it is that's bothering you. So a sponsor that you can call directly for that purpose is extraordinarily important. I like to consider myself a teacher of the 12 steps, but obviously I can't sponsor people that I don't know. that are only listening to me. So why am I doing this again? Because I have the information on how the program is outlined and is intended to be worked. Whether you believe me or not is your decision, but pretty much anything that most sponsees or other alcoholics have said to me, I've been able to back it up in the literature. And if they don't like the literature, then that's not my problem. They don't like the program. They want to fight the program. They want to write another program. That's their prerogative. But if they ask me to help them teach this one program, because it's only one AA program, you may have a different spiritual awakening than me, but the method to get there, there's one program. And it's broken down very clearly into 12 separate parts to equate to one giant step of understanding and practicing. And so if you don't understand the 12 parts, you can't move it into a position. You can't move forward with the program the way it's outlined, because you don't A, understand it, and B, you can't practice what you don't understand. So where do I get that from? Well, that's also in the literature. So if you look at page 125, in the middle of the last full paragraph, it says, "For it is by only accepting and solving our problems that we can begin to get right with ourselves and with the world about us and with whom presides over all of us. Understanding is the key to right principles and attitudes, and right action is the key to good living. Therefore, the joy of good living is the theme of AA's 12th step." So once you've done all 12 steps, you're doing all 12 steps. So you have to understand that's the key to right principles. So these principles are written in here not as a novel and not as a light read, but as a set of directions of understanding. And Bill Wilson wrote them down with the other alcoholics who helped edit the original text in the first 164 pages in 1939. And then in the 50s, Bill Wilson came out with this book, because like I said at the earlier podcasts, the books were being misunderstood and different programs were coming out of them that he did not intend, nor did the original 100. For example, 6 and 7, two paragraphs in the big book. So he wrote a whole bunch of pages on 6 and 7 in the 12 and 12. But if you bring that to some people, they'll say, "Get that book out of my face. I don't want to hear it." Why? Because they don't really want to look at themselves. They think God's going to do everything for them, and all they have to do is be a good religious or a Biblify the Big Book program, and then God will give them everything they need and want. Okay, well, look, take a poll in your room and see how many people are still there or how many people have gone out after 20 years of sobriety or committed suicide, and tell me that their program worked. So, you know, it's really a matter of you wanting to work your own program or not. And the first thing you need to do is understand this one. So this is the reason I went off on that, because step 9 for me is helping others. I'm not just helping myself when I work this program. Yes, that's in the 12th step to carry this message. But making amends also entails me trying to correct some of the damage that I caused in other people's lives. When I was an alcoholic, I persuaded people to do things that they may not have otherwise done. I sold them on things. I gave them messages that were incorrect. So by carrying this message, I'm passing on a correct message to just a certain sect of society. And that sect of society is those who have the disease of alcoholism. I can't help everybody, but I can help the ones that are willing, who are alcoholic, to recover. And that's my way of making an amend to other people in this world. So am I screaming it from treetops? I don't know. All I do know is that this is a very specified podcast for a specific type of person with a specific disease. And if they want to recover from this problem, there is a solution that they can practice and have a contented and useful life. If they don't want to, if they just want to not drink, then they're free to do that. Odds are they'll be miserable or die. That's not even odds. That's one of their two options, is to be miserable or die. And, you know, abstinence will guarantee misery. And who knows how long they'll be able to stay abstinent without committing suicide or going back to drinking and dying that way. That's on them. That's their problem, not mine. My sponsor used to say, of this class, this big book sponsor used to say, okay, well then suffer, you bastard, suffer. And I thought, wow, that's pretty cold when I first heard that. But I get it. You've got a lot of people coming in and out of the rooms, fighting this program, can't stay sober, and then they still want to, you know, tell others that this program doesn't work, but at the same time, they're not working it. So what else can you say to somebody like that after a while? They're choosing to suffer. They know that there's a solution. They're choosing not to work it, and they fight it. So when someone is recovered and they're trying to help, the only tough love thing that you can say to someone like that is go ahead and suffer, you bastard, suffer. It's funny and it's not funny, but it's I get it now. I get what he meant. If he didn't care, he wouldn't have said anything at all. He just would have said, fine, you know, stay silent and watch them die. But at least this way, he's letting them know that he knows that they're not working the program and choosing to suffer. So again, making amends is more than just a conversation. For my intents and purposes, it's carrying this message as well. But that's not enough. Carrying this message is not enough, and we'll get into that in step 12. So what do we need to do? And it explains in the next paragraph when it comes to making direct amends to people that we actually do know. If we go to page 84, it'll say, second full paragraph, much the same approach will apply at the office or factory. We shall at once think of a few people who know all about our drinking and who have been most affected by it. But even in these cases, we may need to use a little more discretion than we did with the family. We may not want to say anything for several weeks or longer. First, we will wish to be reasonably certain that we are on the AA beam. Then we are ready to go to these people to tell them what AA is and what we are trying to do. Against this backdrop, we can freely admit the damage we have done and make our apologies. We can pay or promise to pay whatever obligations, financial or otherwise, we owe. The generous response of most people to such quiet sincerity will often astonish us. Even our severest and most justified critics will frequently meet us more than halfway in the first trial. So we have relationships with people at work as well. In the world, there are friends that we've harmed, and we want to make sure that before we go and approach these people, we need to be ready. You may like want to run out right away and make amends with people. We're being warned against that. He's saying that, you know, take your time, but don't delay too long, but take your time until you have what he calls a tranquil mind. You may not want to say anything and be certain that you're on the AA beam. Well, what is the AA beam? Well, it means that you're practicing the principles. You have an understanding of the program, and you've practiced steps 1 through 8. And now that the time has come to face this individual or individuals, you can, with a clear mind, repair any damage that you need to. And what did we say is the three-prong outline of making an amend? Well, first one is, we admit our character faults, which are mistakes and shortcomings and wrongs, which all equate to how we were selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, inconsiderate, and fearful. How those character flaws hurt them. What did we do to hurt them through those five character flaws? And how are we going to repair them? How are we going to make reparations or pay, financial or otherwise? If we harm them, have we harmed them physically, mentally, emotionally, or spiritually? And if we have, and we admit we're trying to change, which is the third thing, then these people will astonish us with their willingness to probably be very open and receptive to that. And that's a spiritual experience. And the one out of 10 times where somebody can't handle your amend, well, it doesn't matter. Your higher power will still award you with the promises because you cleaned up your side of the street. So is it not worth taking the risk that 9 out of 10 times you're going to be have an open reception? And most of the people that you're making amends to are non-alcoholic, most likely. You know, we're not a huge breed, believe it or not. There is substance abuse problems rampant around the world, and people do drink too much. But only 1 in 10 are alcoholic of the type we are. 1 in 10, that's 10% of the world's population. Now, that's a lot when you take 8 billion people and multiply it by 0.1. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of alcoholics. But if 9 out of 10 people were chronic alcoholics, believe me, this would not be a legal substance. But even when it is legal, the world does have its problems and does abuse alcohol, even though that the consumer may not be alcoholic. So this program, once again, is not designed for the non-alcoholic. So when an alcoholic admits these flaws to another, think about what you're doing. You're doing something that most non-alcoholics will even do. Why? Because they don't have a gun to their head, basically giving them a choice of either drinking themselves to death or having a miserable life and possibly killing themselves because they're so miserable. That is really the only release you have, is this program for survival. So if you don't do it, you'll pay the consequences of not doing it. Not whether I sit here and tell you to do it or not has no bearing. You're going to do what you want to do. But if you do this work and you do actually practice these principles and take the action, you will find that the promises that we read, we'll read at the end of this podcast and have read in step two, will come true for you. And that is the only release that I know of as a chronic alcoholic that really works. I've tried all kinds of other programs, psychologists, psychiatrists, self-help books, anything you can think of, spiritual camps, retreats, everything. And I could not get long-term sobriety, no matter what I did. There was illusions of long-term sobriety laying ahead, but never was it true. So if I don't clean up my side of the street with all people that I've harmed, even groups of people, let's say it in an office setting, I certainly have to do so if I expect a peaceful mind. And what did we say when we studied the literature earlier in step 4 and 5? An alcoholic needs peace. And without the guilt and remorse being lifted, and this is the way to lift the guilt and remorse, you will never have peace as a chronic alcoholic, drinking or not. So this is what we do, and this is why we do it. So let's move on and read a little bit more. Page 85. This atmosphere of approval and praise is apt to be so exhilarating as to put us off balance by creating an insatiable appetite for more of the same. Or we may be tipped over in the other direction when in rare cases we get a cool and skeptical reception. This will tempt us to argue or to press our point insistently. Or maybe it will tempt us to discouragement and pessimism. But if we have prepared ourselves well in advance, such reactions will not deflect us from our study and even purpose. Well, I just explained our study and our purpose. So you have a study and even purpose if you've done the prior 8 steps. You're not looking for an outcome. You don't know what the outcome of the amend is going to be. We're not tempted to argue because what did I say when somebody decides to tell you what you did wrong? You say thank you. You say thank you and you listen and you let them say what they need to say. We don't get into what their problems are and start criticizing them. That is the first thing that you should remember every time you open your mouth. Am I criticizing them or am I just accepting what they have to say? So there's going to be some skeptical receptions. There's going to be times where we don't like the reaction, we don't like the outcome, but we just have to keep a cool head and move on to the next one. And you can't do that when you're in your disease and you haven't asked your higher power for help to remove your character flaws in 6 and 7. Okay? So we are now, you know, in the middle of doing the step. So what happens next? Well, let's look at page 85, second full paragraph. After taking this preliminary trial at making amends, we may enjoy a sense of relief that we conclude our task is finished. We want to rest on our laurels. The temptation to skip the more humiliating and dreaded meetings that still remain may be great. We will often manufacture plausible excuses for dodging these issues entirely, or we may just procrastinate, telling ourselves the time is not yet, when in reality we have already passed up many a fine chance to right a serious wrong. Let's not talk prudence while practicing evasion. This was my biggest one. I didn't want to do it after I was halfway through. I was amazed before I was halfway through, and I said, all right, if I'm going to feel like this, I don't need to rock the boat and bring more in people into this. I'm doing well, and that's the whole point, right? Well, no. There are the people in the never list. Like I said, and what Bill suggested at the beginning of this book, of this step, was we need to have a now list, a maybe list, and a never list. Well, if I go through all the nows and a couple of maybes and stop, then my subconscious is going to start to bubble up the guilt and remorse from the more difficult ones that are ahead, the dreaded ones, he says, and humiliating meetings, seemingly, at least. So we come up with those excuses, which we did in step 8. So now we need to revisit step 8. Is it blame, denial, or fear that I'm getting into to not make amends to those more difficult cases? Or am I just going to wait and say, oh, it's never a right time? Well, we've passed up a few fine chances, so what are we doing? We're not doing the amend wherever possible. Now, that word wherever comes in, it doesn't say whenever possible. There's a big difference between whenever possible and wherever possible. Sometimes it's just not possible. And so the only force that's going to create that opportunity for you is your higher power, the universe, reality, whatever it may be. I've heard amazing stories about how people have bumped into each other on trains and planes and restaurants, and then you just, or parties, and you just didn't expect to see that person there. That's a wherever possible. You didn't choose the place and time, your higher power did. That's a wherever possible. So that is when you have to pocket your pride, muster the courage, say the serenity prayer, ask for God's help, and face that person and remember your outline. What did you do? What character defects are you admitting? How you're going to repair the damage, and what it is that you're trying to accomplish in the end here, and that's to try to change. It could be a person you simply embarrassed yourself in front of at one point, and it's just a simple matter of having a discussion with them about that incident. Or it could be something really big, and you need to set an appointment with them if they can't do it right then and there. But there they are, so you better get started. So we're talking about a new way of life, right? That's what we're doing here. So kind of what I just shared blends into the next paragraph on page 85, towards the bottom, third full paragraph. As soon as we begin to feel confident in our new way of life and have begun, by our behavior and example to convince those about us that we are indeed changing for the better, it is usually safe to talk in complete frankness with those who have been seriously affected, even those who may only a little or not at all aware of what we have done to them. The only exceptions we will make will be cases where our disclosure would cause actual harm. These conversations can begin in a casual or natural way, but if no such opportunity presents itself, at some point we will want to summon all our courage, head straight for the person concerned, and lay our cards on the table. We needn't wallow in excessive remorse before we have harmed, but amends at this level should always be forthright and generous. So back in high school, I don't know why these high school analogies kept coming up, but high school affected me. So, and I was, you know, aware of myself in high school. I wasn't that little. I did things in my disease that I don't want to face. And there were people that I gossiped about and talked behind their back, and they don't know it, but their life was changed as a result of my actions that I took place behind their back. I also did it in business. Let's not limit everything my experience just to high school, but in business, I talk about somebody behind their back, and they may not get a piece of a deal or a piece of a deal that they were entitled to, that they would have used, to obviously feed their family. If I hadn't lied about them in a management meeting. So what do I do with those people? They're completely oblivious to the fact that I've harmed them. Well, this book is telling me that I've got to help people make amends to people that don't even know I actually harm them. Well, that's a tough one. That takes this to a new level. So there's, I had to go back to a kid's life that I kind of wrecked a little bit back in high school. I wouldn't say I destroyed his life, but I certainly changed the course of it in a negative way. And I had to make amends to them, but I didn't know where they were. And then one day, all of a sudden, I get a phone call from the guy seeing how I was doing. And I was like, wow, if only he knew. And of all the people that would call me out of the blue to see how I was doing, he was completely oblivious to what I did to him. That just made it more and more obvious that this amend had to be made. So I had to talk to my sponsor and said, look, he doesn't know that I've harmed him. I mean, now that I'm looking back on it, I actually do feel kind of guilty, because when I heard his voice, I realized right away that, what I had done. And he said, you owe him an amend, no doubt about it. You owe him an amend. You need to sit down and tell him what you did and try to make it right. And that's it. And so I thought about it, and I said, do I blame him? No. Do I deny I did anything? No. Was I in fear of the outcome? Absolutely. I was fear of being embarrassed. And so I was creating excuses not to do it. So then, yeah, I went into denial. Well, maybe it wasn't like I did anything at all. Let bygones be bygones. All of that, it says in step eight, we went over in the last podcast. So next thing I knew, I'm on the phone with him, and then I didn't make an amend immediately. I had to run to my sponsor and talk to him about it, and then I decided that I needed to make an amend. And he visited me here. He happened to be visiting the city I was in, and there's that wherever possible. I'm astonished by the wherever possible and how my higher power creates these opportunities. You just know in your gut you got to take advantage of the opportunity. Your higher power is putting it right in front of you. There is no, ifs, ands, or buts whether or not it's wherever possible or not. So I had to do that. There's some other people that I'm saving amends for later. I did something really bad, and I'm not ready to make the amend yet. And they're not aware that I'm even in AA or I'm doing this, and this amend can be made. At another point where it's possible, it's going to require more of a cash outlay to do so, to make this amend that they deserve more than words. And I'm waiting for some businesses' commissions to go through before I actually do it right. There's no time limit here. There's no, it doesn't have to be done immediately. But I know that this has to be done before my life is over, and hopefully theirs. And so, if it's possible and these business deals go through, I'm going to be able to do that. And if they don't go through and I never have the money to pay the debt back the way I should, I'll face them and address it when I believe that that idea I have on how to make the amend will never happen. I'm praying on that. We'll see what my higher power decides. It's not something I need to do right now, and it's something I want to do right. So that's another example. So that's really what we have to do here is be forthright and generous. We don't want That's what I want to be. I want to be forthright and generous. And I don't want to wallow in my in remorse before those I've harmed, and I want to be able to correct the damage to the best of my ability, depending upon how much time I have and how much time they have is up to my higher power. So how do we know whether it's going to cause damage to another person or not? That's we like to use that clause to get out of it, don't we? Okay, so here we are on page 86, first full paragraph. There can only be one consideration which should qualify our desire for complete disclosure of the damage we have done. That will arise in the occasional situation where to make a full revelation would seriously harm the one to whom we are making amends, or quite as important, other people. We cannot, for example, unload a detailed account of extramarital adventuring upon the shoulders of our unsuspecting wife or husband. And even in those cases where such a matter must be discussed, let's try to avoid harming third parties, whoever they may be. It does not lighten our burden when we recklessly make the crosses of others heavier. Bill Wilson emphasized and re-emphasized this point in the big book and in this book, that we may not need to tell our spouse we cheated. What point does it have? Is it going to harm them? And if it does need to be disclosed based on the conditions of the situation, do we say who it was with? I don't know. Do we throw people under the bus for no reason? Are we harming the person we're making the amend to, or another person who's a third party? I don't know. Who are we throwing under the bus to ease our conscience? Is the question I ask myself before I move forward. But yes, I need to throw myself under the bus. I mean, if I'm going to be harmed as a result of the harm that I caused, well, that's fear. And that's one of the examples I gave just a few minutes ago. You know, if my life has been recreated, I have a new spouse, new job, new life, and there's this amend I need to make that is haunting me, and I refuse to make it because it's going to harm me if I make it and my new lifestyle, then that doesn't count. Others aren't going to be harmed. I'm going to be harmed, but maybe that's how it needs to be in order to remove the guilt. So you really need to think about, well, I'm going to be harmed. Doesn't say if I'm going to be harmed, I don't do it. It says if the person we're making amends to or other people, not us. So there are consequences to our actions when we make amends, depending upon, the extent of the harm we caused and the damage we've done. And we've got to be willing to face that, whether it's jail time or, losing a job. If no one else is hurt, we do it. And the people who don't, you know who they are in the rooms over time. Once you get to know them, these promises aren't, they're fading away out of their eyes. You can see it. So don't become one of those people because you refuse to live in God's will and carry out God's will, which is to make these amends. Let's read on. Bottom of 86, many a razor-edged question can arise in other departments of life where the same principle is involved. Suppose, for instance, that we have drunk up a good chunk of our firm's money, whether by borrowing or on a heavily padded expense account. Suppose that this may continue to go undetected if we say nothing. Do we insistently confess our irregularities to the firm, or in the practical certainty that we will be fired and become unemployable? Are we going to be so rigidly righteous about making amends that we don't care what happens to the family and home? Or do we consult those who are to be gravely affected? Do we lay the matter before our sponsor or spiritual advisor, earnestly asking God's help and guidance, meanwhile resolving to do the right thing when it becomes clear, cost what that may be? Of course, there is no pat answer which can fit all such dilemmas, but all of them do require complete willingness to make amends as fast and as far as may be possible to a given set of conditions. So, yes, let's say you did recreate a whole new life, and you now have a new wife or a new husband, and if you go back to a prior act that you committed, that new wife or husband may suffer as a result of you losing your job. I don't know, are they really going to suffer? Or are they just not going to be as comfortable as you would like them to be? There's a big difference between comfort and suffering. You're not suffering if you're not comfortable. Okay. Shouldn't be the basis. Remember we said, we read, in step 6 or 7 that most alcoholics put, comfort before character, and character building's left in the dust in the pursuit of pursuing comfort instead. That's the same situation here. Are we putting comfort before character? And hurt harm means, is that person going to be physically, mentally, emotionally, or spiritually harmed? It does not say that they're going to be financially harmed. A little bit of financial harm is not a problem if it means that you are avoiding going back and cleaning up wreckage of your past. If someone else doesn't get a new car that year, or you know, have to downgrade your lifestyle in order for you to be a happy, joyous, and free person. I mean, how good of a person are you gonna be to that new spouse anyway if you're always in guilt and remorse over your past and it's haunting you and your new marriage? Not good, not good. So you gotta ask these questions, you know? If you're gonna go, if you got a family and you're gonna go to jail and they're not gonna eat, then maybe that's definitely a reason not to go to your employer and tell them about the padded expense account, or tell the police about something that will throw you in jail that day and leave your kids and wife out in the cold. That's different. But we got to talk about these again with our spiritual advisor and sponsor and ask for God's help and do the right thing. I guarantee you, when you do the right thing after you do that, the promises will come true no matter what the set of conditions. And if you don't do the right thing, you're in your will and you're going to suffer. But that's up to each and every person to decide for themselves, because you only have your own gut to go off of. So last paragraph on 87. Above all, we should try to be absolutely sure that we are not delaying because we are afraid. For the readiness to take the full consequences of our past acts and to take responsibility for the well-being of others at the same time is the very spirit of step 9. So I know master manipulators who will say that they're ready to take full consequences of their past act, but the responsibility of the well-being of their current situation is that they can't take responsibility again because their comfort is under threat. That is not what this step says. We have to be ready to take consequences of all of our past acts and to take responsibility for well-being. Well-being means that, are they going to be better off if you're in guilt and remorse for the rest of your life? The problem, they probably won't be. They're going to see a misery in you, and who wants to be with a miserable dry drunk? Or they're going to be out in the freezing cold with no roof over their head and no food on the table. That to me is a real true consideration of their well-being than it is worrying about truly your well-being, and you're using their well-being as an excuse not to make the amend. So we can't be afraid. These are things that we come up with, concoctions and stories that I'm going over and hammering home, that make us afraid. You have to have the courage. You had the courage when you were drinking to harm these people. Now you have to have the courage to make it right when you're not drinking. And that's just simply the hardest part of this program. It's the last of the action steps, 4 through 9. It is the hardest is left for the last part, to finally make it right to those that you know that you had on your never list. So there we are. Now for me, you know, I talk a tough game. I talk tough about the program because I need to. I need to communicate this message as Bill intended. But that doesn't mean that I do it perfectly. I make mistakes. There's amends I still am in total fear of making, and I don't want to make. But I know wherever that becomes possible, my higher power will present it, even if I purposely forget it. It'll be reminded to me when the time comes. It's already happened. There's been situations where I have had to make amends to people that I totally forgot about. I've had an opportunity to make amends to them and didn't. And then I had to go back and do it again. And look them up and say, hey, I saw you at that party. I couldn't approach you then. Wish I had. But I'm calling you now because, you know, we obviously saw each other, and now I need to make it right. So I may cower away from it in the heat of the moment. But maybe the next week I have the courage to look them up and give them a call, because my higher power clearly put them back in my life for a reason. So those are easier ones. And then there's the ones that are excruciatingly hard, like an ex-wife or an ex-husband or an ex-boyfriend, an ex-girlfriend, a best friend that went bad, all those things, cousins, uncles, the difficult ones. We did some harm to them. They may never change. They may not, They may be sociopaths or narcissists, but we don't care. We still had to harm them at some point if we were in our disease, and we need to just clean up our side of the street. No one's saying they have to be in your life after you clean up your wreckage. Once your wreckage is clear, whether there's a new relationship developed or not is your call. They may say, well, I want a new relationship with you. Well, you don't have to have a new relationship with them. If you don't want them in your life because they're dangerous to your recovery, then you have every right to clean up your side of the street and say no thank you after that. And if they're expecting you to crawl before them or be served Highland scraping, you absolutely do not have to do that. So that's why you need a sponsor to help you understand the difference between the two. So I you know, have a lot of experience in step nine, and you're going to probably make mistakes as I did, but hopefully this education will help you avoid some of them. And when you do make them, you'll at least understand how you learn from them. And that's what we do in step six and seven. We learn from our mistakes. It's a willingness to grow and learn. And you're going to make mistakes as you make amends as well. We're not going to be perfect. We have to be ready to do our best to know and learn and not be perfect. And that also goes with making amends. So I hope that the last three podcasts explain thoroughly what it is we're doing. I read literally all there is on step eight and nine in the big book and in the 12 and 12. I've only added my own personal experience. So I highly recommend that you read the literature as well in conjunction with the podcast. And if there's anything in there that you think is just my opinion, send me an email. If not, then, you know, you may just not like the program, but that's not my problem. I've had people say, I don't like this program. You're teaching me to do things I don't want to do. I'm like, okay, well, then that's not for me to decide whether you're going to do this program or not. I'm only here to teach this one program. And if you choose not to want to understand it or choose not to practice it, that's on you. I have to sometimes be a little bit contrite about that because people don't want to listen if I'm sitting here trying to convince them to do something they don't want to do. The program is there for their taking if they want it, and I'm here to help explain it if they want to do it. So in any event, I love you all. I hope that you're doing better and your recovery is going well, and God bless, and I look forward to getting into step 10 soon. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.